Our next sponsor is Podcorn. Podcorn is a marketplace that connects podcasters with great sponsorship opportunities like host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. Podcorn takes out the middleman so podcasters of all levels have a chance to monetize their podcast, setting their own rates and having full control over their collaborations.
We started using Podcorn a few months ago and it's already changed the game. We can actually make some money from podcasting, which means we can put more time into doing what we love and trying to produce quality content. I found the site so easy to use, podcorn.com. You'll find the link in our show notes. It really is easy to navigate and you can view loads of different sponsorship opportunities right there on your screen. It couldn't be easier to pitch a proposal to a brand to work with them on a campaign. Podcorn makes sure podcasters are able to keep their creative freedom and have full control over how and when we monetize. They also have automated payment, which means you get your money as soon as you've submitted your work. If you're a fellow podcast host, definitely check out their site, podcorn.com. In April 1922, the bodies of the six inhabitants of the Hinterkaifeck farmstead were found brutally murdered. They had been dead for close to a week, but someone had been living in the house for days after the murders. Perhaps they had been living there before, too. This is Hinterkaifeck.
Sixty-three-year-old Andreas Gruber and his 72-year-old wife, Cazelia Gruber, lived in the Bavarian farm, just over 40 miles north of Munich. The 35-year-old widowed daughter, Victoria, also lived there with her children, 9-year-old Cazelia, known as Celie, and 2.5-year-old Joseph. The farm was built near the village of Groben in the late 1800s. Cazelia Gruber had inherited the farm from her first husband in the late 1880s and tended it with her second husband, Andreas, until they passed it on to their daughter Victoria when she got married in 1914. Groben was a small village, mostly inhabited by peasant families. A lot of the young men had been sent off to fight in the First World War, and many didn't return. Those who did were not quite the same. The farm was fringed by dense woodland. It was built in the shape of an L. As you walk onto the property, the farmhouse was on the far left. Entering the house from the front door, there is a master bedroom. On the left, Victoria's bedroom on the right. Continuing down the hallway, you come to a kitchen. On the left of that, there is a small bedroom where the maid slept. And on the right, there is a hall that leads to the feeding stables. If you walk through the stables, you can access the barn and the engine room. All of these areas are connected in a 90-degree angle, with the engine room and barn on the right-hand side. There was also a tool shed and a utility shed where the laundry and baking could be done. The farmhouse had three stories, a cellar, the ground floor with the living quarters and farmhouse, and an attic that ran above all of the buildings. Victoria married Carl Gabriel in April 1914. That August, Carl was enlisted in the German army for the First World War. He was killed on the front lines in December. Victoria was heavily pregnant with their first child at the time. The Grubers were known to be reclusive and kept to themselves. Many people believed that they had a lot of money, but they didn't seem to want to part with it. Post-war Germany was rife with problems like recession and famine. After Victoria's husband died, her father forbid her to remarry. This was likely due to the fact that he was abusing her. He was convicted of incest-related crimes 3 times in the 10-year period prior to the incident in the late spring 1922. Victoria even spent time in prison for the incestuous relationship with her father in 1915. 4 years later, Victoria gave birth to another child, Joseph. In 1921, Andreas and Victoria were caught having sex in the stables by the maid at the time, Crescence Rieger. Victoria had a brief relationship with a man who lived in the neighbouring farm, Lauren Schlittenbauer. Andreas would not allow the relationship to continue, allegedly keeping Victoria locked away. When Victoria announced that she was pregnant with Joseph, Lorenz reported her to the police for incest yet again. Depending on the account you read on this case, Joseph's paternity is debated. Lorenz eventually claimed that he was in fact the little boy's father. Victoria was liked in the village. She wasn't as quiet as her parents and would happily chat to others while at choir practice or shopping in the local store. Victoria had a beautiful voice, and she was one of the best in the church choir. About 2 weeks before the murders, the priest found a large sum of cash in a confessional box. He surmised that it could only have come from the Grubers. The Hinterkaifeck farmers were the only family to have that kind of money. When he asked Victoria, she said that she had left it there as a donation. Some people speculate that the priest may have intercepted an exchange meant for someone else. The family were scrutinised by the locals, for the incest, and because they were seemingly wealthy. Andreas believed that the farm would be burglarised. They'd started making improvements on the farm and apparently had a large sum of cash waiting to pay for the construction of a new farm building. Lauren Schlittenbauer eventually moved on from Victoria. Her father would not let her marry. He was clearly a domineering presence over both his wife and his daughter. He had said, "My daughter doesn't need a husband. That's what I'm here for." Lorenz married Anna in 1921. Anna had a child from a previous relationship, and like Victoria, she was berated for having an illegitimate child. Things seemed to be going fine for Lorenz and Anna. He wasn't very present in young Joseph's life. But he had children from a previous marriage, and a baby on the way with his young new wife, Anna. Lorenz had accepted Joseph as being his son. He'd paid the alimony when he first took responsibility, but a new law was supposedly coming into effect. And this meant, with the post-war inflation, the alimony owed to the mother of an illegitimate child was to increase too. Supposedly, Victoria had gone to court to inquire about this.
In late 1921, the Grubers' maid quit. She had been feeling uneasy in the house. At night, while she tried to sleep, she would hear footsteps on the wooden boards in the attic above her room. Andreas had found a newspaper from Munich on the property. They had never been to Munich, nor did they recognise the publication. The postman, Joseph Mayer, later said that he was repeatedly asked by both Andreas and Victoria if he had ever seen anyone on their property. They told him about the Munich paper they'd found and asked if he accidentally delivered it, but the postman didn't recognise it either. One of the family members believed she saw a man standing near the edge of the woods that surrounded the farm. They never informed the police, likely because they had been in trouble with the law before and wanted to avoid drawing any more attention to themselves. In March 1922, Andreas noticed something in the snow in the yard. Footprints leading to the farmhouse, but none leading away. Another time, Andreas noticed that the lock on the engine house had been broken, but there was no one inside and nothing had been taken. The family heard noises in the attic again, and armed with a rifle, Andreas went to investigate. There was no one there. Andreas also noticed the only key was missing. On Thursday, March 30th, 1922, Andreas spoke with the next-door neighbour, Lauren Schlittenbauer, and told him about the tracks in the snow and the break-in in the engine house. The next day, Friday, March 31st, the replacement maid, Maria Baumgartner, arrived at the farm at approximately 6 p.m. and was introduced to the family before being shown around and cooking a meal. Maria was a 44-year-old woman who had trouble maintaining employment. She had mild disabilities, but she was excited about her new position with the Gruber family. That night, something horrific happened on the farm. Over the weekend, people began to notice the silence on the Hinterkaifeck farm. The machines weren't running. Victoria missed choir at Sunday service. And by Monday, Silly's teachers in the school in Groben noticed that the little girl was missing for a second time, having been absent on Saturday. Passers-by didn't worry too much as there was still smoke coming from the chimney and they could hear the animals in the shed. A carpenter walking past the farm on Saturday night had noticed someone standing in the courtyard. The person then walked into the house and returned with an electric torch. The man shone the bright light into the carpenter's face, which frightened him enough to leave quickly. On the Tuesday, a repairman had been scheduled to come to the farm to fix an engine in one of the machines. No one answered the door when he called, so he went ahead and fixed the engine in the shed. When he came back out hours later, the family's dog was tied up outside, and someone had opened the barn doors. He called out to see if it was Andreas, but there was no reply, and he left. He went to the next house, belonging to Lauren Schüttenbauer, and asked him to tell the Grubers that the work was finished. Lauren sent his sons to the Hinterkaifeck farm to see if there was anyone home. When they got back, they told him that they didn't see anyone, but they could hear a whimpering noise in the cattle shed. That evening, Lawrence went to the farm along with two other neighbours, Michael Pohl and Jacob Sigel. When they got there, they found that all the doors were locked, bar the door to the machine house. They broke open a gate and managed to get into the barn. Walking through the stables, Lawrence stumbled on something in the hay. It was only when Michael shouted that there was a foot that Lawrence realised what he had stood on. He pulled the foot and uncovered the body of Andreas Gruber. The disturbed bundle of hay revealed more bodies, those of Victoria, Cecilia, and Silly Jr. Fearing that his son had been injured, Lawrence then ran to the house to find 2.5-year-old Joseph. He found him in his bassinet. His head had been shattered. In a room across from the kitchen, Lawrence found the maid Maria. She had been lying dead on the floor, under the bed covers. Lawrence sent his son to get the police and the mayor, and they arrived shortly after. The postmortems were performed by Dr. Johann Baptist Aumüller in the courtyard of the farm. Although there are no official autopsy reports for the victims, there are accounts of the injuries and communications between a doctor and the authorities, which notes most of the wounds that had been inflicted. All of the victims had suffered blunt force trauma. Victoria, Silly, and Maria had small, round, pencil-sized wounds. Cecilia had 7 wounds to her head. Her skull had been cracked and it appeared as though she may have been strangled. Andreas had severe facial injuries caused by blunt force trauma. Victoria had 9 star-shaped wounds on her head. The right side of her face was smashed. She had 1 round puncture wound on the top of her head, and she also appeared to have been strangled. There are some reports by those who went to the crime scene that young Silly had had her throat slit. They also claim that she may have had tufts of hair in her hand. She may have pulled it out in agony, as it doesn't appear as though she died right away. She would have been lying helpless for hours as she bled out, surrounded by the dead bodies of her mother and grandparents. Silly also had a small round puncture wound near her nose, which at first led witnesses to believe she had been shot. Joseph was found in his bassinet. His skull had been smashed. The killer had struck through the hood of the carriage with such force that it penetrated the material, hit Joseph in the temple, and shattered it, causing blood and brain matter to cover the interior of the hood. The maid, Maria, was found with a 4-centimeter hole at the back of her head, and her skull had been smashed on the right-hand side. Henrik Ney was working for the prosecutors at the time. He was present for the autopsies and examination of the crime scene. He noted that while they were moving the bodies from the barn to the courtyard, there was a rope hanging down from a beam above them. It appeared as though someone had lowered themselves down from the hayloft above. There were 2 handprints on the beam where the rope had been tied. There were 2 indentations in the hay where the investigators believed 2 people had lain in wait. There was also human feces found nearby. Roof tiles had been raised in 4 places, which meant that the intruders could have a 360-degree view of the property. The police used dogs to try and track the killer's scent, but nothing could be found. The killer must have lured the family members out to the barn one by one. Investigators tested to see what could be heard from the house, but they couldn't hear anything. Maybe the killer had let one of the livestock run out, and when someone went to put it back in, they were attacked. One by one, the victims must have went out to the barn to find out what was taking so long, only to be killed. Most of the victims in the barn had injuries to the right side of their head. This led the police to suspect that the perpetrator must have hidden behind the door and attacked them as they came in. After killing Andreas, Cecilia, Victoria and young Silly in the barn, the killer went into the house and killed the maid Maria and 2.5-year-old Joseph. They then stayed on the property for days, possibly even feeding and milking the cows. During the autopsies, the victims' heads were removed and sent to the pathology department at the University of Munich for further analysis. The heads were also taken to clairvoyants, who said that there had been more than one murderer, and they stayed in the house for some time after the killings. Sometime between the chaos of the Weimar Republic and the bombings in World War II, the heads were lost and never recovered. All 6 victims were buried on Saturday, April 8th, in Weinthoven, headless. CrimeCon, the world's number one true crime event, is coming to London next summer, partnered by Crime and Investigation. On June 12th and 13th, 2021, we'll be in London along with more than 20 other amazing true crime podcasters on Podcast Row.
There will also be 5 stages with over 50 hours of incredible true crime content, from cold cases, notorious cases, authors, survivors, and of course, other true crime fanatics. Be sure to follow CrimeCon on social media at crimecon_UK and on crimecon.co.uk, where you can buy your tickets. Use our code CRIMELAPS for 10% off. See you there!
Let's recap the strange incidences that occurred on the farm before we get into the theories and the suspects. There were footprints that led from the north side of the property towards the barn. There were no footprints leading away. Andreas Gruber reported this to at least 3 people. Footprints were also seen near the farm by a hunter around the time of the murders. Gruber had also told people that he suspected someone was trying to break into the engine house, but nothing was stolen. The Münchner Zeitung Munich newspaper was found near the courtyard on the edge of the woods. Andreas Gruber asked the postman if he dropped it, or if he knew someone who subscribed to the paper. He seemed very concerned. On Friday, March 31st, 1922, the day of the murders, Celie fell asleep in school. When the teacher asked why Celie was so tired, she said she'd been up searching for her mother in the forest the night before, after she'd run away. She was then found sitting on a tree stump close to the house, disputed whether Seely was referring to Victoria or Cazelia in this instance. Either would have reason to run away. Victoria was groomed by her father for an incestuous relationship for years, and he would not allow her to marry, and Cazelia was said to have been abused by Andreas. Days before the murders, Andreas told neighbours that he'd lost his only house key. The family reported hearing noises in the attic. The day before the murders, Andreas Gruber was in an iron shop in Skrobenhausen. He said that he had to get home because he was worried there was something wrong in the house. He said that he didn't sleep the night before because he heard footsteps in the attic. He said he went up with a light and his rifle, but he didn't see anything. Victoria also made similar statements that she'd heard noises. The police offered a reward of 100,000 marks for information leading to the apprehension of the killer, but very little turned up. They first assumed that it was a robbery gone wrong. Many of the original police reports state that money may have been missing and Victoria's room was ransacked. But only Victoria's room was ransacked. There were still almost 2,000 marks left around the house. Were they looking for something in particular? Or was the mess caused by the many people who turned up at the crime scene before the police did? The initial suspect was an escaped psychiatric patient named Joseph Bartel. Bartel had been suspected of committing a robbery on a farm 3 years earlier and had escaped from an asylum over 60 miles away a year before the murders. He was never found. 10 miles from Hinterkaifeck, a farmer had died after being violently attacked. Joseph Bartel was accused of being responsible, but it's not clear if he was. There were a number of similar crimes committed on farms near Hinterkaifeck in the months before and after the murders, but none as brutal or perplexing. In the other attacks, someone escaped and was able to tell the police that there were two men wearing masks. Could there have been men targeting farms in the area? Another theory is that Victoria's husband didn't really die in the war and was living in the farmhouse in secret. Some believe that he saw that Victoria had another child while he'd been away and snapped and killed everyone. And although Carl Gabriel's body was never found, this theory is highly unlikely. There was a large sum of cash allegedly stolen from the house, but this can't be confirmed or denied because the only people who would know are dead. In 1923, the house was demolished. And in the attic, under loose floorboards, there was a pickaxe-type tool found. It was caked in blood and had female hair on the top. The tool had been crudely made by screwing a sharp hoe to a wooden handle. The screw came out of the back of the handle, past the screw nut by about a centimetre. Some of the victims had pencil-sized stab wounds when they were found. This was attributed to the screw. The killers must have hit them on the back of the hoe. This also explains the star-shaped injury. George Siegel identified the tool as having belonged to Andreas Gruber. He said that Gruber made the weapon himself while he was working as a farmhand a few years earlier. Also found when the house was demolished were an iron band and a penknife. Two men were seen in the area a few days before the murders, around the same time the footprints were found leading to the farm. They were identified as possibly being Carl Bischler and George Siegel. George had worked as a farmhand on Hinterkaifeck before, and was suspected of having stolen from them. They both had alibis for the night in question.
Carl's brother Anton was also suspected.
He'd worked on the farm before and allegedly taken a fancy to the Gruber's previous maid, Crescence Rieger. The family warned her not to get involved with Bischler because he was a known thief. Bischler would come and knock on Crescence's window and try to convince her to let him in. She told the police that the family's dog, who would bark and growl at anyone other than the immediate family, never showed any aggression towards Anton Bijla. Anton was not the only man to knock on the maid's window and proposition her. A stranger knocked one night. She didn't recognise the man, but he said his name was Sepp von Groben. She suspected it was Anton's brother Karl. Crescens had given birth to a baby girl in the farmhouse in 1921. When the child was less than a year old, she was placed into foster care by the local doctor because he believed she wasn't being taken care of properly. She'd been pregnant when she arrived at Hinterkaifeck. Child's father died that same year. Crescens also said that Joseph Thaler, one of the notoriously criminal Thaler brothers, came to her room one night in 1921. Thaler asked Crescens to open the window as he wanted to be friends. She said that she had enough friends already. Her baby was asleep next to her. Thaler kept asking Crescens to open the window, but she refused. While they were speaking, she could hear noises outside as if someone was walking on the leaves near where Joseph Thaler was standing. She asked him who he was with, and he said there was no one. Thaler told Crescens that he knew the Grubers had a lot of money in the house. After that, he left. The maid walked to the kitchen where she could see him speaking with another man outside. She believed it was his brother, Andreas. Crescens had left the farm in the winter before the murders because she feared that she was being watched by someone. Aside from the footsteps she would hear in the attic, her bedroom door would also open in the night.
Another set of brothers were suspected, Adolf and Anton Gump. There was speculation that Adolf had a relationship with Victoria, and he was known to have killed before. Along with three others, Adolf was wanted for the murder of 9 farmers in Silesia a year earlier. Some suspected that Victoria was pregnant with Adolf's child, and that is why they were all killed. The autopsy determined that Victoria was not pregnant at the time of her death. In 1941, Crescentia Mayer, Adolf and Anton's sister, confessed on her deathbed to the local priest that her brothers had been responsible for the murders at Hinterkaifeck. This information was only used in 1952 by the prosecutor Andreas Popp. He had suspected Adolf and Anton, but Adolf had died 6 years earlier. Anton denied any knowledge or responsibility for the murders, and the case against him was dropped in 1954. There is also a theory that the farm was used to store weapons and military equipment after the First World War. Some believe that the murders may have been politically motivated assassinations. There is not much evidence to support this theory. After the murders, it emerged that Slettenbauer had only claimed paternity of Joseph on the promise that Victoria would marry him. When he was first listed as Joseph's father in September 1919, he reported Andreas Gruber to the police for incest. At this stage, he claims Victoria came to him crying and begging for him to say he was Joseph's father, and she would give him the money to pay any alimony. When he said he was Joseph's father, Andreas was released from jail and the charges were dropped. Andreas still would not let his daughter marry Lawrence. Some believe this was motive for him to kill the family. The lead investigator on the case, George Reingruber, noted that when he arrived at Hinterkaifeck the day after the bodies were discovered, Lawrence had really inserted himself into the investigation. He offered to care for the animals. But this could also be explained by the fact that it was possibly his son that was killed. One of the men who went with Lawrence that day recalled him opening the barn with a key. Andreas had said that the only key was missing days before the murders. Lawrence was also seemingly calm in amidst the brutality of the murders. He did not seem horrified at all, even moving the bodies. When he was searching through the hay that covered Cecilia, Andreas, Victoria and Silly's bodies, he was screaming, "Where's my boy?" He cleaned a path for people to get past the bodies, completely disturbed the crime scene. While other witnesses were terrified, he had no problem entering the house alone. He said he did that because he wanted to take care of Joseph. Maybe he had been in shock and having failed to protect his son and Victoria, who he'd been in love with at one stage, he just wanted to feel like he could be useful. Lawrence and his wife Anna had had a baby a few weeks previously, and the baby died just days before the murders. Sigil, who went to the farm that night with Lawrence, publicly accused him of being the murderer. He later recanted. In the 1920s, it was a great offence to accuse someone of a crime, and you would have to pay them money for the damage done to their honour. Many of the people in the village suspected Schlittenbauer, but he protested his innocence until his dying breath. He was a severe asthmatic, killing six people with a heavy tool in quick succession. Without being discovered, would be a difficult job for a man in his condition. His wife Anna shared the load on their farm. She was a capable woman. In the end, the police did not think Schlittenbauer was guilty, or at least they couldn't prove that he was. There have been over 100 suspects considered in the almost 100 years since the murders occurred. In 2007, students at the University of Applied Science in Fürstenfeldbruck, near Munich, re-examined the case using modern techniques. They were able to establish who the killer was most likely to be, but out of respect for their living relatives and under data protection laws, they did not publicly name their suspect. Did the police focus too closely on one theory and one suspect and completely miss the killer? Did the killer slip through their grasp? Was it some transient murderous duo hiding in the attic waiting to rob and kill the family? Was it Carl Gabriel faking his death in the war and seeking revenge on his incestuous in-laws? Was it one of the many pairs of brothers suspected by the former maid? Was it one of the Schlittenbauers, having just lost their baby daughter days before and fearing that Victoria might try and take money from them again? After spending days trawling through forums and pages on the incredible website hinterkaifeck.net, as well as other contemporary sources and translating the 2007 thesis done by the student detectives, we are still unsure as to who killed the six inhabitants of the Hinterkaifeck farmstead or why they did it. After all this time, we will likely never know. Rumours have fused with facts to leave us with some sort of blurred horror story that has no definitive conclusion. That is what makes it one of the most puzzling cases. Thank you for listening to this episode. But if you've liked what you heard, please leave us a review or some feedback. You can support us by listening to the show, leaving reviews, or join us on Patreon. We'll be back with our next episode in 2 weeks' time.